Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about vaccines on the show today. We'll look at the COVID-19 vaccine. We'll also look at flu vaccines with our guest, Dr. James Conway. But before we talk with Dr. Conway, we're going to talk with my old pal, Jill Nadeau, who is with me. She's got a big smile on her face, and she's all ready to talk about the fall member drive. You know, here at WPR, listener contributions are the largest source of funding, and your gift keeps the programs you value, including this one, on the air. So I hope you'll make your contribution now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. Joe, how are we doing?
We're doing amazingly well. Last hour, we had 45 new and returning members. Thank you so much for those gifts. And today only, all contributions up to $60,000 will be matched by a group of very generous members.
Yeah, indeed. They encourage you to join them in support of Wisconsin Public Radio. So you can double your support for the programs you love when you give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Now, you enjoy listening to Wisconsin Public Radio in part because, you know, we're commercial free, but that means that we depend on other sources of funding. So state, federal, and business sponsors are important. And there's another source that's very important, too.
Sure. The largest piece of funding for WPR programs comes from you. Your support makes all the difference. It's the backbone of how things work around here. And when you give, you keep quality, independent talk and information on the air. So make your gift right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And the beauty of making a voluntary donation is that you decide how much to give. WPR is listener supported, and that means the more donors we have, the more secure our funding. So how much you give isn't as important as the fact that you do give.
I know many first-time donors give $100 or maybe $10 a month, but you decide the amount that's right for you. Since contributing is your choice, and because WPR is something you value, you'll find that donating feels really good. Jill and I can attest to that fact. Find out right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
I think it's a great business model in that it operates using donations from people and donations from corporations. It works. I'm happy to donate because I think it's so important. And I'm happy to donate more because I know there's some people out there that can't. It's just great company in the house. I'm Mary from Menominee, and Wisconsin Public Radio is my source for everyday listening.
Go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552 and make your donation in support of the programs you count on. Larry Mueller here with Jill Nadeau. Your support today of Wisconsin Public Radio keeps all the programs you enjoy going strong. And you might contribute $10 a month. You might contribute $100 a month. You know, whatever it is, we appreciate and we count on your gift.
And supporting Wisconsin Public Radio right now is a great thing to do with just a few minutes of your time. All we need is your name, your contact information, how much you'd like to give, and how you'd like to pay.
Your gift supports the stories and the programs that keep you connected to the world. So give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And don't forget, our big dollar-for-dollar match is still in effect, so it's a great time to support the WPR programs that you love. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and your support for WPR will go twice as far.
And in addition, support Wisconsin Public Radio and ask for the new WPR baseball cap that Jill and I will be soon supporting and wearing. That WPR logo, we've got it on the front. You'll show off your public media pride wherever you go. And you can ask for yours with your gift. I have $10 a month or more at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And if you're not a sustainer, well, become one right now. It's easy to set up convenient ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or your credit card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And your first year of contributions, that's the first year, will be matched right now. Michelle in Marshfield says, I couldn't get through the day without WPR and NPR. Thank you for keeping me informed and entertained. Autumn in Mason says, thank you for the quality content.
So your gift is very powerful. It really makes a difference. If you haven't done it yet, go right now to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552 and make your contribution. And thank you. We are turning our attention to vaccines, vaccinations on the show today. Our guest, Dr. James Conway, he's UW Health's pediatric infectious disease specialist and medical director of the immunization program. He's also a professor at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And as we visit with him, what questions do you have about the COVID-19 vaccine? What would you like to know about this year's flu shot? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Dr. James Conway, welcome back. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Good to be with you.
Before we start talking about specific vaccines, I think it'd be worth it to talk about, for you to explain how a vaccine actually works.
Sure. I mean, the idea of a vaccine is it's basically trying to trick the immune system into essentially thinking it's already had a disease. And what they do is basically stimulate the immune system and hopefully all parts of the immune system. You know, the immune system is pretty complicated, but to try to get both the what we call T cells and B cells to both get activated and ready. And then when they're confronted by the actual pathogen, by the actual infectious organism, that they're already ready to go and have had a jump start on being able to protect you.
And the process, what's the process of developing a vaccine?
Yeah, it's complicated, but it's been really well sorted out over time. I mean, essentially, you know, people start in the lab with trying to figure out what are the important parts of the organism that really do stimulate the best immunity. They often then test them in animals, and then they move into what are called the clinical trials. And so they work through phase one, which is healthy individuals just trying to figure out what the right dose is. Then they move into phase two and phase three, which is then actually giving them to people that would be the ones ultimately receiving the vaccine and then seeing how well it protects them, as well as developing tests to make sure that they actually can detect the vaccine immunity. And then they're eventually reviewed by initially the FDA, and then they move on to the American Council, the Committee of Immunization Practice, which is an advisory to the CDC, and they're the ones that basically determine which parts of the population should get that vaccine. They then move on to the Secretary of HHS, who's the one that ultimately then signs off on it, and it becomes policy. So it's got a lot of checks and balances along the way. Obviously, there's data review committees throughout the process that, you know, make sure that everything's being done safely. And shut it down if it, you know, there's any concerns. And it's, you know, complicated in that there's a lot of steps, but I think that's built for all of our benefit to make sure that vaccines do the two things that they're supposed to do, that they're supposed to be effective and that they're supposed to be safe. And so I think that's where we've got a really good process at this point.
Yeah. And was the COVID vaccine developed the same way or differently?
It was developed the same way. What they were able to do was basically take out a lot of the bureaucratic parts of it and basically put all hands on deck, especially at the FDA level. You know, in previous years, FDA had at various stages a full year to review things was kind of the way the rules worked before they had to respond to the companies and give them the go-ahead to move to the next stage. And obviously in the midst of a pandemic, that wasn't acceptable. And so they were really able to streamline. And to be honest, I think many of us that have worked in this space for a long time always thought that there was just too much bureaucratic administrative logjam on a lot of the stuff. And so I'm actually hoping that this is kind of the new normal, that these things can be done a little bit more efficiently. But none of those steps were compromised. There was no shortcuts or anything like that. It was just making it more efficient.
Dr. Jim Conway, our guest today, UW Health's pediatric infectious disease specialist, talking with him about vaccines, zeroing in a bit now on the COVID vaccine, but we'll talk flus as well. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I know Pfizer's, ready to give their vaccine to kids under 13. What should we know about that?
Well, I think we need to know that, you know, we're basically going through that same process I just talked about. And, you know, I think people need to remember that back in the spring of 2020, when this all started, the first thing that was done was figuring out what's the right dose for adults. And so each of the companies tried, you know, sort of a small, medium, and high dose to figure out which one worked the best and was still safe to give. And so that's the stage all the companies are kind of moving into with these different pediatric age groups. So Pfizer has worked through and figured out that they can get away with about a third of what the adult dose is. And so for those 5 to 11-year-olds, they've now got at least some good preliminary data that it seems to give a good immune response. We're still waiting to see, you know, the rest of the data as far as the efficacy and safety, and making sure that it's going to be reasonable to give it to kids. So while they, you know, released those press releases earlier this week talking about the fact that they're making progress, it's still going to have to go through all of that review process before it's ready for prime time.
Yeah, and so that could be a while yet? Quite a while, or?
Well, I mean, they're signaling at the FDA level that if the data is submitted in the next few weeks, that they're hoping to have it all reviewed by the end of October. So I'm anticipating that we should be able to start getting shots in arms for at least the 5 to 11-year-olds, you know, certainly by the end of the year. You know, we're hopeful that it even could happen sometime this fall. But, you know, again, you don't want to rush things, and you want to make sure that we're crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's.
As you were talking, I was thinking about my days and my working on my PhD and data analysis and all that, and that was a long time ago. Things are a lot faster these days than they were back when I was finishing my degree.
Yeah, certainly the computer and artificial intelligence ability to process a lot of this data, you know, has really allowed things to be sped up and really made more efficient. But a lot of it is still, you know, a lot of really smart people like yourselves and others that really do need to dig into the details. You know, while the companies obviously are, you know, prioritizing, you know, doing this right, you know, we always want to make sure there's checks and balances. And so those data analysis and statisticians are really critical.
Let's talk about boosters for a minute and maybe the necessity of getting boosters. What seems to be the consensus right now?
Yeah, the current consensus, the advisory to the FDA met last Friday, and, you know, in looking at the data, they really felt very strongly that these vaccines are really holding up quite nicely for the majority of the public. They're really doing what they need to do, keeping people out of the hospital, keeping people from dying, keeping people out of intensive care units. And so, you know, the decision was that there's at least some preliminary data that suggests that there may be less of a robust immune response in older individuals, which isn't a surprise because obviously we have special flu vaccines geared to help those people get a better immune response. So I think the over 65-year-olds and then patients who have or people that have a real risk of having a particularly severe version of COVID, so people that have underlying medical conditions, are also going to be factored into that. You know, while we're certainly understanding that there's going to be some breakthrough infections, you know, some mild cases in healthy people that have been vaccinated, that's pretty tolerable if you're otherwise a healthy person. But if you've got a significant underlying medical condition where even a mild case could actually go bad, that's going to be the other group that they're going to probably consider and probably recommend boosters. The advisory to the CDC is actually meeting as we speak yesterday and today to review all this, and hopefully by the end of the day today there will be some decisions on what that booster program is going to look like.
Mm-hmm. Dr. James Conway, our guest today, great talking with him about the immunization programs for COVID and for the flu, and certainly looking forward to hearing from you with your questions or comments, and I hope you'll join in. I know Jill Nadeau wants to join in again because we're in our fall member drive, and she's back with me to talk about your gift. Your gift right now is so important. And that's because gifts from people like you are the largest source of funding for our shows. You keep the Larry Mueller Show and all the shows you enjoy going strong. So go ahead and invest in your future listening right now. Go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552.
And a group of generous members have created a challenge today, up to $60,000 to inspire you to support WPR today. For as long as it lasts, your gift will be matched.
Good news. I tell you what, we've had a number of people. I think we have about a dozen people who have contributed so far during this hour, and that's great. But there's still room for you to get your challenge match. You can double your impact for the program you value. Just give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Maybe you listen to WPR with your kids and enjoy how it sparks conversations. Or at dinner, you might share something you heard earlier in the day.
Public radio is a start to quality conversations, I like to say. And your support right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 keeps the connection going.
Absolutely. Sustaining members provide vital and stable support for WPR. So if you're already a sustaining member, thank you for your ongoing support. And if you aren't a sustainer yet, why don't you become one right now?
I was having a beer last night with a couple of sustainers, as a matter of fact, and they're happy to be sustainers. Why? Because it's an ongoing, automatically monthly donation from your bank account or your credit card. It's easy to set up. Just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552, and you'll feel really good every time you listen, knowing that your support is always current.
You turn to Wisconsin Public Radio to keep you informed and connected. Now, with the new WPR baseball cap, you can show off your support for the news, talk, and music you rely on everywhere you go. Where would you wear your WPR baseball cap?
I would wear my WPR cap when I'm walking around my neighborhood listening to podcasts. I would feel super cool.
Any activity outside when you want to protect your face from the sun's harmful rays?
To the dog park, because I feel like it would be a perfect way to strike up conversation with fellow dog lovers and lovers of public radio.
This tan-colored adjustable hat features the WPR logo and is the perfect way to showcase your WPR pride. Ask for yours when you give $10 a month or more. Here's how.
Just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552. Larry Mueller here with Jill Nadeau, thinking about having a cap party with Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. We'll all get together, maybe have a beer or a soft drink, and praise Wisconsin Public Radio. And that, there are a lot of listeners out there who could do that with us, Jill. Listener support is the biggest source of funding for our programs, the ones you rely on, and that's why your support is so important. Get on board. Maybe your gift is $10 a month. Maybe it's $100 a month. Whatever amount you choose, that's the right amount.
We had a listener call yesterday who said we should do that at Camp Randall.
So, I love that idea.
Yeah, I thought it was a great idea, too. So maybe we can get people to work on that. Today, support WPR, and your gift will go twice as far. So we get twice as many people. All donations, up to $60,000. That's amazing. Will be matched by a group of very generous members.
Usually when we get together, you have that secret handshake. But this way, you could just go with a cap.
That's right. It's perfect.
Yeah. So give now. Your support for the WPR programs you love will be doubled at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Maybe you donated a few years ago and you feel like you've done your part. Well, it's your continued support that keeps WPR going.
If it's been a while since you donated, that's okay, but this would be a perfect time to renew at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. We'll be glad to have you back for sure.
That's right, and you'll double your gift right now. So give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and your support of WPR will go twice as far.
You're supporting Wisconsin Public Radio, and don't forget to ask for that new WPR baseball cap. It's really a nice-looking cap.
It is nice, yes.
And I'll be glad to have it on my head at some point here soon. It's got the WPR logo on the front. You show off your public media pride wherever you go, and you can just ask for yours with your gift of $10 a month or more at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And if you're a sustaining member making ongoing monthly gifts, thank you. We'll make today the day that you increase your support of WPR by, you know, $5 or $10 a month, whatever amount you choose at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And remember, when you increase, your first year of contributions will be matched. Megan in Appleton says, thanks to WPR, I definitely feel more informed and motivated to be part of positive changes in our world. And Leanne in Cottage Grove says, I love the programming, especially the local and regional shows.
All seriousness, your gift right now is very important. Just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552. Make your contribution and thank you. So much. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we talk vaccinations. We're looking at COVID vaccines. We're looking at flu vaccines and certainly answering any questions you might have about the whole vaccination process or maybe your experiences as well. Love to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Our guest, Dr. James Conway, UW Health's pediatric infectious disease specialist and medical director of their immunization program. Just as an aside, as we look at the UW-Madison, Dr. Conway, the program here has been pretty successful, I believe.
Yeah, it's been remarkably successful, and there's a lot of people that really deserve a lot of credit. You know, it's interesting. We're one of the two Big Ten schools that doesn't even have a student vaccine mandate, and yet we have some of the highest immunization rates. You know, we're looking at 99% of the faculty are immunized, well over 90% of the students, and lots more as they're coming back to campus are already scheduled. And we're really proud of them, and I think, you know, it does bear to really give credit that people really do hear or listen to the science. And I think that's been the most important part. You know, I know it's been confusing for a lot of people because, you know, we've essentially been watching science done in a fishbowl. It's been transparent almost to a fault where people are getting overwhelmed with information as things come out. But I think we've done a good job of messaging to the students and to the staff and faculty here. And I've been happy to see that people really listened. We've also, you know, made it easy for people to get vaccinated. The folks over at the University Health Services have really bent over backwards to make it simple for people to get in and get vaccinated.
And it looks like, as we were talking about, it looks like the boosters are going to be on the way. You can't get a booster yet, can you?
Well, you can get a third dose for both Moderna and Pfizer if you're considered an immunodeficient patient, somebody who's got a real immune deficiency. And that program started about a month ago. That's a, you know, limited group of people, probably about 9 million people in the country. The boosters that are being talked about now, as Pfizer has gotten their full licensure and has submitted additional data, was initially started to be discussed with FDA on Friday. They issued their decision last night, actually, that, you know, they're basically approving them for limited populations. And then this ACIP advisory to CDC is talking about it right now, and they're going to vote on exactly what that looks like. I think we're anticipating that, you know, probably by early next week, maybe middle of next week, when all of this is sort of sorted out, that I think boosters will start. And it'll probably be initially for individuals over age 65. Probably going to be also people at high risk for either exposure, so that'll be health workers, maybe police and fire and other groups like that. And then they're going to have to figure out how to categorize other age groups who might be at higher risk for having complications. And I think that's where the devil's in the details, and that's the meeting today that's trying to really sort out, you know, the cost and benefit of doing that. Obviously, there's some side effects that come along with this, but we also want to make sure we protect the most vulnerable. And so that'll be sorted out. I think people will be hearing a lot about that in the media in the next couple of days.
In terms of side effects, what, you know, I had my two vaccinations and I had nothing. I mean, I had the shot and my arm was sore for a little bit, but not bad. But others, I guess there's been some side effects.
Yeah, I mean, most people tolerate it quite well. I think that, you know, for younger individuals, they do seem to have a little bit more of a robust immune response. And especially for the two-dose vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna, that second dose, you know, does, as it activates your immune system, does give people sort of a mild flu-like illness. So, you know, in addition to the sore arm, some people have had a low-grade fever, achiness, and, you know, kind of feel down and out for 24, 48 hours. You know, in rare circumstances, there's been more serious side effects. I think people have heard that, you know, with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, some young individuals, they had some issues with some blood clots if they had a pre-existing condition that predisposed to that. And with the Moderna and Pfizer, some young individuals, especially young males, there have been a couple of cases of myocarditis, some inflammation of the heart muscle. But those have all generally resolved, without any sequelae. So we're certainly watching that stuff very closely. And now that, you know, hundreds of millions of doses of these vaccines have been distributed, we have a really good idea about what those side effects are. And so while they're unfortunate when they happen, they're really rare. And I think everybody has agreed that the benefit of these vaccines being so protective is worth the occasional side effects that some people do have to suffer through. We're not happy about it, but it's really that balancing act that we have to reach.
Well, if it's that small a number, and you're looking at, what is it? I think I saw a number like one in five of every 500 people. Was it every 500,000 people in the U.S. have died from COVID?
Yeah, one in 500. Yeah, I mean, and that was the news that came out. As a sustaining member myself, I listen to NPR all the time, so I pick up lots of great information. And, you know, there was some data that came out that more Americans now have died from COVID than died in the 1917, 1918 flu pandemic, which was really considered one of the most devastating ones. And obviously, we had a lot more people in the country now than we did back then. But the calculation was that one in 500 Americans have died from COVID during this pandemic, which I found jaw-droppingly frightening, especially now that we, you know, do have the tools to manage this between vaccines and, you know, understanding during outbreaks that we need to manage social distance and all those kinds of things. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we can start to get ourselves out of this over the coming months.
Have you seen many breakout cases of COVID in people who have had the vaccination?
We haven't had very many people that had breakthrough cases that were sick enough that they ended up in the hospital. There's been a handful of those. The majority of breakthrough cases are people that either actually have no symptoms, and so often people are getting tested for other reasons. You know, they're coming in for a medical procedure. We test everybody that's coming in, or they're going to travel, and they get tested. And so that's the vast majority is people that are vaccinated. They get exposed. They get infection that doesn't give them symptoms or, you know, very mild symptoms. And I think one of the things that we do need to talk about is that, you know, as we get into winter months, when especially if, you know, society is as open as it seems to be, we're going to start to see more colds and flu and things starting to circulate. And it's going to be important for people to get themselves tested so we know which ones are COVID, which ones are flu, and which ones are just other viruses, because we are still going to have to figure out ways to help people understand when they need to isolate and quarantine and stuff so we don't get into bigger outbreaks. But the breakthrough cases are generally pretty mild or even no symptoms, and we haven't seen a lot of them come into the hospital.
I'm wondering about this whole business of masking now. It's required in Dane County that, you know, if you're inside, you should be masked or have to be masked. And I was thinking, gosh, every year all the students at the University of Wisconsin go off to all corners of the world, then they come back in January and bring back all their new colds and flu, and I'm usually sick in January, practically every year, but I wasn't last January because there was, everything was. There's nobody here. And I'm wondering about the masking, if that's going to perhaps help with some of these other colds and flu.
Yeah, it was a remarkable year last year. I mean, between, you know, a lot of things being shut down, obviously, especially schools, as well as limitations on travel, plus everything we were doing with masking. I mean, the cold and flu season last year just didn't happen. But I think what we've recognized is that as soon as you start to open things up and return to normal activities, you do start to see these things rear their heads again. So I think people have probably heard about this respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, which is usually in Wisconsin kind of a November through March virus, but showed up all of a sudden as soon as, you know, kind of things opened up in July, August. We had a surge of RSV, which, you know, I hadn't seen happen during a summer. But I think it's, you know, sort of a reminder that, you know, these viruses are out there. They're going to start to be transmitted. And so, you know, I think some of the stuff, as we think about this pandemic, you know, I think there's going to be some silver linings at some level. I think, you know, one of those might be that people maybe are going to continue to be a little bit more responsible about trying to stay home when they're sick. I think most of us just try to kind of muscle through these things and you know, kind of ignore them. And I think that's where a lot of these things spread. The masking, you know, certainly helps. I think, you know, most of us hope that we can get away from masks for most normal activities eventually. And, you know, obviously back in the spring when things looked like they were getting better, you know, we did loosen things up pretty nicely. But as soon as the Delta variant kind of reared its head, we kind of had to go back into mitigation activity. And, you know, it's unfortunate because I think if we had higher rates of vaccination, we wouldn't have to be doing so much of this stuff. And I think that was the goal. But I think things kind of stalled there temporarily over the summer. And so we're kind of back to where we started. But if people do really are able to convince more of their friends and family to get vaccinated, hopefully we can get out of that procedure, you know, maybe after the winter. I do think in medical settings, especially in hospitals and clinics, I think masks are going to stick around for quite a while, at least during the typical cold and flu season. I think that may be something that we actually maintain for a while.
Nancy in Grafton, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I've heard that these vaccines were, well, they used abortive fetuses. Is this true?
In the research and testing, yeah.
Yeah, and if this is true, are there some companies that did not use aborted fetuses? And I listen on the radio.
Sure. So it's an interesting question, and this has gotten a lot of press. There, you know, some of the when you work with viruses, viruses by definition can't live on their own, and they need to live in some kind of cells. And so one of the issues when you're dealing with viruses that are infecting humans is that they need to figure out ways of using human cells to be able to at least at some part of the process develop the viruses that are used for the vaccine production. I think people have heard the famous story of Henrietta Lacks and the HeLa cells.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the cells that were used for a lot of things for many, many years. There are some cell lines that were derived back, I believe, in the 70s from miscarried and aborted fetuses that then were used to become cell lines that were used for quite a few different viruses that eventually became vaccines. Those are not used in the production or any other part of the production of these vaccines. There are, you know, over 200 different COVID vaccines that are in development globally, and most of them have to use at least at some level some human cells early in the process. The good news about all this, though, is that, you know, most of the major religious organizations, even those that are opposed to abortion, have essentially granted dispensation that this is really such an important scientific development and so important for humanity that they're not considered anything that would be considered a violation of religious responsibilities, including the Pope and others in the Catholic Church. And so I think it's an important topic. Most of the companies obviously are trying desperately to figure out ways to do these things without using any human cells. You know, some have tried to use stem cells, and obviously there's controversy about that. And some have tried to use other tissue cells from humans. But yes, there are some, at least some stages of the processes for most vaccines for COVID that did have at least briefly some use of those original cell lines.
Nancy, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. Dr. James Conway, our guest today, Jeff and Grand Marsh. We'll get to you in just a minute, but I want to bring Jill Nadeau back in because we're in our Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Member Drive. You count on the Ideas Network for interesting conversations, and of course we count on you to help keep these discussions on the air.
That's right. Listener support is the largest piece of funding that makes this show and all the others that you enjoy possible. That's why your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is so important.
We have a group of generous members. They've created a challenge up to $60,000 to inspire you to support WPR today for as long as it lasts. Your gift will be matched.
That's right. Absolutely. And there is still some money left. So there's still room in this challenge for your gift. But do it soon because it's dwindling. So double your impact for the programs that you value. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thinking about some of our regular guests, John Freiberger, Chad Spate, who help us with our homes. You got Scott Craven, who he's always happy to speculate on your wildlife sightings. The weather guy, Steve Ackerman, and John Martin, the bird guy, Bill Volker, Dr. James Conway, who is with us today, has been with us in the past as well to talk about these kinds of great issues.
Absolutely. And we have plenty of women who come on, too. That was kind of a male-dominated list there. But just Monday, we had our physical therapist. We've got Mary Mellon coming on to talk about taxes soon. Well, they all cover topics dear and near to your heart. They give you advice and ideas because you've come to trust and appreciate these guests. Support this program with your dollars. It's easy to give. Just go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Think about what you spend money on every day. It might be coffee. It might be takeout. It adds up. I know that for sure. And it's easy to spend on things that are part of your routine.
And Wisconsin Public Radio is part of your routine, too. It's your news source, your conversation starter, your place to learn, to spend some money. So spend some money on it today. Start with a dollar a day. That's $30 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I would say that if you really enjoy public radio and you listen to it even occasionally, if it does something to enlighten you on a certain point of view, then that is value. It's valuable. But nothing in life that is of value is truly free. Being a sustaining member, even if you just donate a small amount each month, you know, what it would cost you for a cup of coffee is really, really worth it if you believe in what they're doing. And I do. I'm John from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I encourage you to join me in sustaining Wisconsin Public Radio.
Just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552 to make your donation. Larry Mueller here with Jill Nadeau. Your support during our fall member drive makes the programs you rely on possible, and your gift could be $10 or $20 a month. Whatever amount you choose, that's the right amount.
That's right. And you've made a habit of listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. So now make a habit of donating. And it's a good habit, a habit you can be proud of. Get started right now. Help out with your donation of any amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Dollar for dollar match still in effect. Great time to support the programs you love. And don't forget about the cap. Yeah. Tell them about the cap.
The cap. It's a WPR logo on the front. You know, you can show off your public media pride wherever you go. And I mean, Wisconsin's a big cap state. So you'll be up there with all of your friends. Ask for yours with your gift of $10 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you're not a sustainer, you could become one right now. Easy to set up ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or might want to use your credit card at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. Talking vaccinations on the show today with Dr. James Conway, UW Health's pediatric infectious disease specialist. Great to have him along. And you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Jeff in Grand Marsh, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
I may have a couple of questions, but the first is, if you are in contact with somebody that has COVID, why do you quarantine for 2 weeks? Why is it 2 weeks? Why not 10 days? Why not 5 days?
Good question, Jeff. And actually, this has kind of evolved over time. You know, initially when the coronavirus pandemic started, a lot of the decisions were made based on previous coronaviruses. You know, there's typically coronaviruses that circulate every winter. And so we know that the incubation period for those can be as long as 14 days. What they discovered over time is that the vast majority of people, after they've been exposed, are going to come down with their symptoms in a shorter period of time. So they actually did shorten both the isolation and the quarantine both to match up at 10 days, because I agree with you, it was both frustrating and a little confusing. If you got sick with the disease, you had to be in isolation for 10 days. If you got exposed to the disease and weren't sick, you had to be in quarantine for 14 days. it seemed like we were almost being penalized, penalizing the wrong people. But as more data became apparent, it was clear that they could shorten that isolation period after people were exposed down to 10 days. So both of them match up now.
All right. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jane from Milwaukee called. She isn't vaccinated yet, but wants to be. But she also wants to get her flu shot. She's heard that taking them at the same time can impact side effects. How should she plan spacing on those?
Yeah, great question, Jane. This was something that we were kind of wrestling with. When the vaccines first came out at the beginning of the year, we really weren't sure as they got into large-scale groups of people, we needed to really be able to monitor for side effects. And so the CDC did make a recommendation early on that people should avoid other vaccines for 14 days so we could sort out those side effect issues. Once it was clear what the side effects really looked like and people understood those, they lifted that. And so co-administration of vaccines is certainly permitted at this point. And, you know, for a lot of people, especially because the last few years, as people have missed out on a lot of their health care, quite a few people are behind on all sorts of vaccines. And so it is an opportunity when people are getting a COVID vaccine or getting something else to do them at the same time. But you're right that, you know, especially with the COVID vaccines, the second dose for the Pfizer and Moderna does, you know, knock some people a little bit for a loop just because of that immune stimulation. And I think, you know, for people that have had previous flu shots that had some of that immune activation side effect stuff, they may want to consider separating them when they're getting their second dose. In general, though, that most of the data that we've got now, again, after hundreds of millions of doses have been given, is that there really isn't a whole lot more side effects when multiple vaccines are given together. It's basically when your immune system gets turned on and you get that sort of achy, low-grade fever thing, it's either on or off, and it doesn't seem to be a lot more on if people get their COVID vaccine with their flu vaccine. And so we are encouraging people both to save themselves the hassle, but also help the health systems be more efficient that when possible to try to get multiple vaccines at the same time.
Yeah. If I'm going to have an effect, it's usually with a flu shot. I have a little mild effect with it, but I've got an appointment with my doctor coming up. So I think I'm just going to, in about a week and a half, and I think I'm just going to get them both at the same time if I can.
It certainly makes sense. I mean, if the boosters are ready and you fit into that age group, there's certainly not a lot of reason not to do it. And, you know, one of the things I think that we need people to understand is while they did make some statements that said, you know, for elderly and over 65-year-olds not to get it too early, they were talking about was July, August, when some of the flu vaccines actually started to show up at some of the pharmacies. You know, now that we're well into September and we're already starting to hear about flu starting to show up in low levels in certain areas of the world, I think it is a good time for people to get at least planning towards getting their flu shots sometime over the next month or two so that we're kind of ready and we don't have to deal with the dreaded twindemic that we've been worried about, where if we had COVID and flu at the same time, everything would be really kind of a mess.
A listener emailed to ask if the current trials of the COVID-19 vaccine in children are taking into account that kids take 53 different vaccinations before the age of 18. How will they know which kids in trials are getting the COVID-19 vaccination at the same time or near time they're getting the other vaccines? Couldn't taking COVID-19 vaccines along with other vaccines in children lead to side effects?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, one of the reasons that this is taking a while for the kids, you know, I think that we've all had to remind ourselves that kids aren't just little adults. And even though we tested these things in adults quite extensively, that doesn't mean that everything's okay in kids. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that are frustrated and anxious to get their kids vaccinated. But that's part of the process of making sure that we guarantee both that they work and effectively protect against the disease, but that it's safe to do so. And so, you know, that first stage is just figuring out the right dose in the little ones. Second is then giving them in larger and larger numbers of kids in these trials to see how well they tolerate them and see how well they protect. And then it's going to be also then looking at what happens with co-administration. So that's the reason that, you know, the 5 to 11-year-olds are going to be kind of the first group that are going to be up. But, you know, as the email mentioned, you know, kids are vulnerable to a lot of different diseases, and kids do get quite a few vaccines. Most of those are in the first 5 years of life, and so that's the reason that it's going to take a little longer to make sure all that's sorted out in those younger kids before we move forward.
Yeah. You know, Lindsay had emailed regarding the 5 to 11-year-old cohort and wondering, again, you've talked about it a bit, but wondering when it's going to be available. She's heard it could potentially be going into arms by Halloween and wonders if that is realistic.
Yeah, I think we've heard that from the administration in D.C., that that's kind of their hopeful, optimistic view of things. You know, I think that they're in a hard place. You know, when they announced last month that there were going to be widespread boosters available on September 20th, you know, what they were trying to do is basically giving all the public health and health systems a heads up, like that this is when they were anticipating things might be happening. Obviously, that came and went because we're still in the process of figuring all this out. And I think that's the part that everybody needs to recognize, as we talked about earlier, is that the checks and balances and the review of all this is really a stepwise process. And so, you know, I know Fauci and others have said that they, you know, have some optimism it could be as early as Halloween. I share that optimism. If things go really well, you know, if all the data gets submitted and reviewed in a really efficient manner and it all looks good and all the regulatory bodies really do sign off on it, I could see that by Halloween we could be getting started. But it's an optimistic estimate. I think it's certainly safe to say it's going to be by the end of the year, but it's going to be a couple of weeks before we have a clarity on that.
Dr. James Conway, our guest, he'll be with us up till 12:20 or so today talking about immunizations. It's great to have him with us. Great to have Jill Nadeau back as well during our fall member drive as we approach the top of the hour. You count on the Ideas Network for great discussions like this one. And it's your gift, any amount that makes these discussions possible. Your support's the largest source of funding for our shows. And that's why your support is so important. Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 and make your contribution.
And a group of generous members have created a challenge for us, up to $60,000 today, to inspire you to support WPR. For as long as it lasts, your gifts will be matched.
That's really good news, and I think we still have around $8,000 left in that.
It's going fast.
It's going fast, so jump on the bandwagon before it's gone. Double your impact for the programs you value. Give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And discussions like the one we've been having, where we hear from the people that are informed, the people that are doing the research, the people that know, like Dr. Conway, about vaccinations, because there are so many things out there, so many news articles, or, you know, your friend told you this, your friend told you that. Well, you know, when you go to WPR, you know that the people that you hear know what they're talking about. And it enriches your life, and it's unique. Public radio is super unique. And you know what? We're listener supported. So that means that when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, you make this hour and many more hours possible. So choose an amount that works for you. Just take a few minutes and make your gift.
And ask for your WPR baseball cap. For sure. You know, it's a tan-colored hat. It looks great. It's got a bright WPR logo on the front. And your support of the programs you love will shine wherever you go. So it starts, though, with your gift of $10 a month or more at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
We've probably all had this happen. We spend money on something and then hardly ever use it.
I would say closets and closets full of clothes that I never wore.
I bought a pair of backcountry skis a few years ago that I have never used.
I bought an extremely cheap violin case that was so cheap that I threw it away within 10 minutes of opening it.
Unlike some investments, your donation to Wisconsin Public Radio is a good one. One you'll get value from every day. Make your gift to support the programs you count on right now. Here's how.
Just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552 to make your donation in support of the programs you count on. Larry Mueller with Jill Nadeau. Your support today of the programs you enjoy is so, so important. And your contribution could be $10 a month, might be $100 a month. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount, and we appreciate it.
We absolutely do. And you know that today your support for WPR and your gift will go twice as far. So all donations up to $60,000 will be matched by a group of generous members. And that amount is dwindling fast. There's only $8,000 left. So do it now.
Give now. Your support for the WPR programs you love will be doubled at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And you know you support the things that make your life more meaningful, and Wisconsin Public Radio is one of those things. Here you get information about events in our region and the world. You also get music, humor, and storytelling.
And I know you're going to want a lot of news and information in the coming year, for sure. Your
yes.
support makes it all possible. So make a difference at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 with your a gift of the amount that's right for you.
That's right, and our exciting dollar-for-dollar match is still in effect, so give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and your support of WPR will go twice as far.
Dr. James Conway is going to be with us after the news to talk some more about immunizations. I know Claire in Milwaukee has a question. We have an email. You can join in, too, with your questions for him, but right now, why not take a minute and make your contribution. Go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552. Make your contribution in support of the programs you love. Larry Mueller with Jill Nadeau. We'll be back right after the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Just want to mention, we have a great team of people working on this program every day. Trina LaSousa, Tyler Dinner, our engineers today. We got Jill Nadeau, Natalie Guyatt, Jane Rotunda, all our producers, and they all do a wonderful job, and I want to thank them so much. And also want to thank Dr. James Conway for coming by and being with us today as well. UW Health's pediatric infectious disease specialist, also a professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about vaccinations. What's confusing to you about, or what questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Claire in Milwaukee's been waiting a bit, so let's get to Claire. Thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you for this important discussion. I wanted to make a comment, and then I have a question for the doctor. My comment is that I personally know three people who had breakthrough COVID recently. One couple is like near 80 years old, and all of these people were fully vaccinated prior. And they took a trip abroad to Europe for 3 months, but they just went to visit family. So they stayed put when they were there, had full PPE, traveled very safely, came back. And within 6 weeks, about 6 weeks after they were back in their small town in southeastern Wisconsin, both developed breakthrough COVID. And if they didn't have relatives in the healthcare field to monitor them and give them the proper attention and everything, it could have gotten quite serious for them. And then another person I know actually works in healthcare and as a physical therapist, and he most recently had breakthrough COVID. Didn't know it because he's an allergy sufferer, but when the smell and taste went, that's when he knew, uh-oh, I got to get checked.
Mm.
So, you know, it's definitely out there. My question for you, doctor, is regarding the takeaways that our society is hopefully learning from living through these times. How do we as a society, the medical community, our legislatures and legislators, and even just the common everyday folk who work for employers, how do we move the employers to allow people from this day forward to have more sick time available to them so that they can recover from true illnesses, even if it's just the quote-unquote common flu? How can we achieve this so that perhaps as a society we can learn something from this and stay well longer in the future?
Boy, great stuff, Claire, and really appreciate both your comments and your question, because both of them are really important. On the first thing, on the breakthrough, you know, those are both great examples of exactly why the booster discussion is so important. You know, the older individuals, you know, despite all their efforts to protect themselves, those are the folks where the immunity just doesn't seem to last as long or be quite as robust. And in these groups that are in high exposure situations, health workers, potentially, you know, first responders, you know, there's clearly a lot more exposure risk and a lot more quality of exposure we talk about, where there's just a lot more volume of virus that they may be around. And so while they're vaccinated and protected from severe disease, these are the groups that I think we're going to see, at least at the first wave, of needing and getting boosters to try to make sure that they're protected. As far as the rest of society, I think you really raised some interesting and important points. You know, I think that for far too long, we've decided that illness is something that's sort of your problem rather than all of our problem. And we really have not only dissuaded people from taking time off, we've made it difficult for them. And I think that's something that's really a problem with how our economy and how our society has evolved. You know, there's a lot of countries that have really prioritized maternity leave as well as sick leave to try to protect the rest of their society. And I do think that we're going to need to reconsider that. And I think that employers for many years fought against these things because they thought it diminished their productivity. But I think they're hopefully starting to realize that the dramatic impact of a pandemic and, more importantly, of a local outbreak within their own facilities really can lead to even more dramatic problems where they actually have to shut down operations, shut down production lines. And so I think we've seen a shift in their behavior. You know, for instance, early on in the pandemic, when we saw a lot of the food processing places get shut down because of outbreaks, suddenly those employers were not only insisting on getting access to vaccines for their employees, but they were actually starting to even talk about mandating it. And so I think that there's going to have to be a reckoning from all of this, where we're going to need to, at a legislative level, try to push for statutes that basically protect employees and also reward employers that actually have these kinds of policies in place that both protect their own industry but also protect their employees. I do think that there's going to need to be people banding together to be heard, whether it's through elections and getting people on the ballots that are supportive of these kinds of things, or whether it's employees and workers organizing together to really make sure that their voices are heard. But I agree with you 100% that we are going to really have to rethink this. The other thing is that, you know, we've tolerated a lot of this for too long. I think the fact that we've tolerated, you know, 30 million flu cases a year and, you know, somewhere between 10 and 50,000 deaths from flu every year, I just think that that's something that we've got to get over. And I think we've got to start to recognize that every life is valuable, and we really need to do things together to try to protect everybody, especially our most vulnerable. So I'll stop there, but you really do raise a lot of good points, and I hope people continue having those kinds of discussions.
Yeah, and Claire, thank you so much. A great comment and a great response from Dr. Conway as well. Appreciate it very much. You could join in too, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. A listener emailed to ask if there's a more potent flu shot for older people this year or a different shot.
Yeah, good question. So there are a couple this year that are available for individuals over age 65. So one of them is called Fluzone High Dose. And that's been around for a while, and that's basically just a lot more of the antigen, the stuff in the vaccine that stimulates the immune system. There's another one that's come along more recently, which uses basically the same amount of antigen, and it's adjuvanted, so it's called Fluad. And it's basically got an immune stimulator within the vaccine that basically helps the immune system respond better when it's exposed to those antigens that are supposed to stimulate the immune system. So both of those are available this year in pretty large quantities, and I think that both of them are really preferential for individuals over age 65 to make sure that they are fully protected during this next flu season.
Ron from Milwaukee wondered in an email if some of these of the people who are anti-vaxxers are maybe just afraid of going to the doctor and getting the needle, getting the jab.
Yeah, that's a really interesting comment. You know, one of the things that, as we've studied vaccine hesitancy, that I think is important is that, you know, it's a lot of this comes from confusion and just the deluge of information. And, you know, the human mind is sort of set up that when you're overwhelmed, the natural response is to basically sit tight and do nothing. And so I think that a lot of this has really been confusion. There are actually, when we've studied this, you know, small groups of people that are completely opposed to vaccines. It's really that there's a large group of people that either want more pertinent information to them or want information that's from a trusted source or want it distilled down in a manner that actually is understandable and that they can act upon. And so I do think that from a public health standpoint, that we need to do better on the messaging, you know, with people that are trusted within communities, but also making it in a form that's really understandable for people. And I agree with the comment, though, is that, you know, I think that it's overly simplifying things to just kind of pigeonhole people and say that they're anti-vaxxers. I think a lot of the vaccine hesitant folks are well-intentioned. They just want more information, and they want information that pertains to their own situation.
Harry in Spooner, let's give you a chance now. Thanks for joining in.
Sure. Good morning. My wife and I both had breakthrough cases just very recently. We were vaccinated, fully vaccinated back in February. We got the monoclonal antibody infusion treatment the same day that we found out we had positive tests, and that worked very well, reduced our symptoms. In a matter of days. But I'm wondering, moving forward, if this series of events, the breakthrough infection or the treatment with the antibodies, gives us either any additional protection or in any way reduces our protection moving forward.
Yeah, really good question, Harry, and really interesting. And sorry to hear you guys got sick, but glad that you were able to respond as quickly as you did. And, you know, the monoclonal antibodies, I think, are something interesting that hasn't gotten as much press or as much discussion as it probably should have. You know, the idea for these is that essentially it's the idea of, you know, you may have heard about convalescent plasma. So early on, what they did was when people survived the COVID infection, they would actually take their blood and then take their plasma and essentially give people that were really sick antibodies that had already been formed by another human as they had fought off the infection. And then as science moves so quickly nowadays, they were able to figure out a way to basically synthetically make those antibodies and to give them to people that were at high risk for having complicated infections early in the infection, if possible, to prevent them from getting severe disease. And it sounds like you benefited from that and had some good guidance. The problem with those is that it's really relatively short-lived immunity. So those antibodies really only hang around for a couple of months. And so temporarily, you probably got sort of superhuman protection against the SARS-CoV-2 virus, but it is going to fade away as those antibodies break down. And so you'll likely be eligible for a booster. We're going to wait and see exactly how they frame this, but what we've been generally recommending is that after people get those antibodies, that they actually need to wait 90 days after they get the antibodies just to give them a chance to break down, because what we don't want is, as you get a booster or get your first doses of vaccine, that you get a blunted response to it because your body is already sort of thinking like, oh, I've already got some immunity against this. I don't really need to do much about this. And so the idea is basically letting those wash out and then getting your booster afterwards. So you raise a really good point. I'm glad you brought it up because I think it's important for people to know about.
Yeah, Harry, thank you so much. Chris in La Crosse, what's on your mind?
Hey, Larry, I'm a huge fan. I've been listening to your show for a while, and I just had a question in regards to employer mandates on vaccines and how there might be some anti-vaxxers who, let's say, are believers in the word, and, you know, there's commandments that say, like, do not be afraid, be strong and courageous, and then there's warnings that say, like, you know, there's merchants with their pharmakia and all goyim will be deceived by the pharmakia. I'm just curious how people might be safeguarded or otherwise create issues with vaccine mandates and
how they might sidestep things, in other words, a bit. Any comment on that, Jim?
Sure. Yeah, so, you know, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, you know, are the ones that are sort of responsible for determining what kind of employer mandates and what employers can do. And, you know, early on, they did issue guidance that even when the vaccines were under emergency use authorization, that it was up to the employers, and they certainly could choose to mandate vaccines, but that they were required to give people options out for medical contraindications or for religious reasons. As the vaccines get licensed officially through the FDA with what's called a BLA, a biological license, the rules change a little bit, but not a lot. And so Pfizer is the first one that's got a full licensure. But, you know, basically the way they've handed down the mandate rulings is that for companies over 100 people, they can mandate the vaccine. They do need to make some allowances for people that have specific beliefs and medical contraindications. But it's really up to each of those companies to determine how they're going to adjudicate those, how they're going to actually review them, and which ones they're going to accept. There certainly will, I would expect, you know, ultimately be some lawsuits that'll sort out the details. But, you know, all of that stuff is sort of built into how the rules work to make sure that, you know, we're not violating people's individual rights when there's a good reason to defend those. So it's a fine line that they're walking, but I think they've actually navigated it pretty well because there really hasn't been a whole lot of yelling and screaming about it, despite the fact that we're seeing not only healthcare organizations, but more and more employers also jumping in on the requirements.
Chris, thanks again. And James, thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's really been, it's always a pleasure to have you come by, and you do a wonderful job. So thank you so much.
Happy to do it, Larry. Keep up your good work, too.
Dr. James Conway, the medical director of the immunization program. I have trouble with that word. I don't know why. At the UW Health. And he is a pediatric infectious disease specialist. Another specialist is Jill Nadeau. She specializes in helping me, as in particular, talk to you about our fall member drive. And here we are, relying on you to keep the programs like this one going strong. And I hope you do it.
Absolutely, because listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR programs, and that's why your gift of any amount is important right now to make, and it's going to make an important difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, Jill, I've done some math in my head. And
have you now?
And I see we have about $2,300 to go on the matching, ooh, and that would be about 19 caps. Think about it. If we,
okay,
if we had 19 people to give us $120 or $10 a month, we are over $2,300, and we will have reached that goal. And so what a good time for you to contribute right now. You get the cap, and you are also doubling your impact.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we don't have a lot left over of money right now. So now is the time to do it. And you know, when you wear that cap, you just encourage everyone else to join in with you too. So double your support and get that great cap for the programs that you love when you give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You might not have a life coach or a personal trainer or an infectious disease specialist on your speed dial, but that's what we are. That's what we're here for, isn't it? When you
it
listen
is.
To the Ideas Network, you get relevant and factual advice from all kinds of experts. And what's the cost to you? Well, you get to choose. The Ideas Network is your source for helpful information, so support it now. I would love to go over get to that $2,300 by the end of this program. So let's do it right now. Help us support WPR, all the programs. Just go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552.
And when you join the WPR team, and, you know, we always win, Larry, on our team. And with the support of the new WPR baseball cap, well, it's got the WPR logo on the front, and you can show off your public media pride wherever you go. So wear it on a hike, wear it to a ball game, the grocery store, wherever. This cap will be your new favorite accessory, no matter where you go. So ask for yours with your gift of $10 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
On WPR, you get fact-based news, you get high-quality entertainment, informative talk, great music. You get a rich experience, I think, no matter when you tune in.
Absolutely. You know, and this depth and breadth is possible thanks to listeners' contributions. So make yours now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you've never given before to WPR, I would suggest you do it today. You can find out how good it feels.
Yes, it feels great. Because you'll be supporting something that you love, something that you use and rely on every day. And because the largest source of funding for WPR comes from listeners like you, you can know that your donation truly makes a difference. So make your first ever gift of $100 or $10 a month or whatever amount is right for you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
My name's Kelly Davis, and I live in Whitewater.
I'm Kathy Ross, and I live in Whitewater. I'm originally from North Carolina, and there, public radio was very much part of my life. And so about 6 years ago, I came to southeastern Wisconsin to be closer to my family. And one of the things that my daughter told me before I got here was, Mom, you're going to love WPR. And she was right.
All the credit is mine for introducing my mother to WPR. Probably one of the better things I've done for you, huh, Mom? Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I would agree.
Yeah.
Make your contribution today because listener support makes Wisconsin Public Radio possible. Give now at WPR.org and click donate.
Easy to do. Just give at WPR.org or you can phone too. Phone 888-202-2552 and make your contribution. Larry Mueller with Jill Nadeau. Listener support still our biggest source of funding for the programs you rely on, and that's why your support is so important during our member drive. Your gift could be $10 a month, could be $100 a month, whatever amount you choose, that's the right amount.
It is the right amount, and giving to WPR is easy. All it takes is a few minutes of your time and a gift of any amount, say that $10 a month.
That donation comes back to you every day in the form of great programs. So show your support at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552, and please give as generously as you can.
Absolutely. Everyone should make the gift that works for them. And for you, well, that might be a gift of $100 or $200 a month.
Maybe that's what you pay for cable or your family phone plan. Listening to WPR is something you do every day, so put a value on it, like other things that are important to you, at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And however you choose to give, thank you. Your support is powerful. And today, there's still something more that you can do to help encourage a friend to join the Wisconsin Public Radio community.
You can spread the love. Tell your friends, tell your family that you support WPR, and you might inspire them to do the same at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
That's right. You know, a $10 a month contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio, it works out to just 33 cents a day. Now that is a good value.
It is a good value indeed. And our dollar for dollar match is winding down here. We've still got a ways to go. I was really hoping, and maybe we can still do it. Maybe we can still knock it off here in this next couple of minutes. You can help us out now with that dollar for dollar match. And, I want to take a minute and just say thank you. Thanks for listening to our show. We love to have you joining in and listening and supporting us in that way. And I hope you'll support us financially, too. If you haven't done it yet, do it right now. Go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552 and support Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks again so much for contributing and listening. I'm Larry Mueller with Jill Nadeau for the Ideas Network.